I am Abby Chin, and this is another episode of CSN's The 86 Celtics Interviews podcast. We have quite a treat for you. Basketball Hall of Famer Bill Walton. He was only a member of the Celtics for two seasons, but the passion with which he has always spoke about the franchise is unmatched. Walton, of course, was the star of the John Wooden UCLA teams that won an incredible 88 games in a row and two national championships. His NBA career began in Portland, where Walton led the Cinderella Trailblazers to the 1977 NBA title. But injuries to Walton started piling up. He played in only 57% of the regular season games during his 10-year career. He was rejuvenated, however, when he was traded to Boston in the summer of 1985. Here is our extended interview with Bill Walton, conducted by the director of CSN's documentary on the 86 Celtics, Tori Champagne.
What a fun team. We had everything. We had brilliant leadership in Red Auerbach, fantastic ownership. At the executive level, Jan Vogt, coaching Casey Jones, and then the players. Because at the player level, you had all these different kinds of totally unique guys who were historical in their relevance and perspective. And then at the end of the day, you had Larry Bird, and nobody else did. Plus, we had the remarkable Boston Celtic fans who just drove us. And one of the great things about being a Celtic player is that the fans, they make you better than you can possibly ever get on your own. And I grew up a Celtic fan, even though I'm from the heart of Southern California and the heart of Laker country, to see what the Celtics were able to do. I became a Celtic fan because of Chick Hearn. Chick Hearn, the Laker broadcaster, the greatest broadcaster I've ever heard. And Chick's respect, admiration, and awe of the Celtics, and in particular Bill Russell. And so here was little Billy with his then red hair and his big nose and his freckles and his goofy, nerdy-looking face and horrendous speech impediment, listening to the radio as a young boy starting in the early 1960s to hear him talk about Bill Russell. And then when my mom, who was our town's librarian, brought home Bill Russell's first book, Go Up for Glory, I just devoured it. And it changed my life forever. And I said to myself, that's what I want to do. Bill Russell is my favorite player ever, on and off the court. Red Auerbach, who is the patriarch of basketball. And then Larry Bird, who was the greatest player that I ever played against. There was remarkable players across the entire roster. Dennis Johnson was the best guard in the NBA. And then Robert Parrish was the foundation of the team. He was just a tower of strength and a pillar of nobility and grace. And Robert was so graceful and so dynamic and so vibrant, but also so quiet on the court, which was perfect for the combination that he had with Larry and Kevin, who were extremely vocal. Kevin McHale was the second greatest low post player that I ever played against in my life. And he was just an incredibly unique and exhilarating player who loved every aspect of basketball, loved every aspect of life. And then you had Danny Ainge, who was truly a phenomenal athlete in anything and everything and could play and run all day and just a genius of a human being. And then you had on the bench, you had guys like Scott Wedman and Jerry Seasting, as great as shooters as the game has ever seen. You had Rick Carlisle, a fantastic team guy and a leader and a real cerebral thinker out there. You had Greg Kite, the rugged physical guy who was willing to get in there and just mix it up. And Greg really thought that basketball was like bowling and that he was the ball. And everybody else was just the pin who was just there to get knocked down. And then you had Sam Vincent and David Thurdkill, just two tremendously talented young role players who were very gifted physically, but really didn't get much time because of all the greatness of the other players ahead of them, the veterans. And then there was Casey Jones. We loved Casey. We would do anything for Casey Jones. Casey Jones was the most like John Wooden of any coach I ever played for, on and off the court. Casey Jones was the bridge from the foundation at the beginning to the present at the time. And he was so dignified. He personified class, professionalism, and he was just the perfect coach for our team. And no matter what he asked, no matter what he said, we just said, great coach, let's go.
I was going to say, you just quickly kind of compared him to Wooden. What was the kind of the correlation between, what was it for you that was kind of unique about Casey and Wooden that were related to each other for you?
Casey Jones was one of those guys who always saw the big picture, never got bogged down in details, never got bogged down in minutiae, never got bogged down in negativity. It was always about moving forward. It was always about doing whatever he could, whatever we could do as a unit to win the game. And there was no ego out of control with Casey Jones. There was no self-promotion. There was no individual agenda. It was all about the team. It was all about us. And we knew that Casey Jones cared about us. We knew Casey understood what it meant to be a player in this most sacred of leagues, the NBA. We knew that he knew what it took to become the champion. And he was a brilliant psychologist. He was totally on top of the pulse of the team. And Casey Jones always made it fun. We could not wait to get to practice every single day. It was a joyous celebration of all things good in life. And I'm the luckiest guy in the world to have been able to be a part of it.
Bill, if we could, I wanted to just go back to the summer.
Sure.
You coming here, there was a lot of speculation. I mean, I talked to Jackie McMullen about this, about at first it seemed like you wanted to go to the Lakers, and then there was this opportunity to come to the Celtics. How did that play out for you, and what was that like kind of being in the middle of everybody discussing you were coming to Boston?
I'm a San Diego boy. San Diego's the greatest place on earth. And growing up here in Southern California, I always wanted to be here. I called the Lakers about being on their team. Jerry West, a lifelong friend. Jerry said, no, Bill, I've seen your feet, and we don't want any part of that. And so I called Red Auerbach, and I got Red on the phone, and I found out later that at the time I got Red on the phone that he was having a meeting with Larry about the future of the team. And so when I told Red that I wanted to come and be a Celtic, Red said, please hold the line. And so Red put his hand over the phone and looked across the desk at Larry and said, hey, Larry, this guy Walton's on the phone from California. He wants to come be on the Celtics. What do you think? I was told later on by both of them, Larry and Red, that Larry leaned over immediately and said, Red, go get him. And so it completely changed my life because I knew that when I got there, that the basketball would be fantastic. I had no idea how good, because you don't really know how good these guys are as players until you play with them and against them every day. And they were truly remarkable players, all of them. Danny, DJ, Scotty, Chief, Kevin, Larry. What I didn't know was how fantastic the life could be in Boston and in New England. Here in California, we know full well that if the Pilgrims had landed here, that the East Coast would still be wilderness. But when I got back there, I was flabbergasted by how incredibly warm, receptive, genuine, and visionary life was back there in Boston, in Cambridge, and New England. And Red, Larry, the Celtics, the people in New England, they didn't give me my career back. They gave me my life back.
I was going to say it's pretty remarkable. You ended up landing in Cambridge and kind of became part of the community. They kind of embraced you very quickly. That doesn't always happen, and a lot of players aren't nearly as gregarious as you are. So what was that like? You kind of touched upon it, but really becoming one of the guys that everybody kind of related to very quickly in Boston.
I didn't know anything about Boston other than going to play against the Celtics and having been there with the Grateful Dead and on their tours. But my great friend David Halberstam, he recommended that I move to Cambridge. And he found my realtor And he found the house we ended up living in, and it was perfect. We were just up on Avon Hill, just above Radcliffe and Harvard Square, and I would take the Red Line to the Green Line to the Boston Garden, and I could drive across the backside of town and get over to Newton and Larry's house. But living in Cambridge was absolutely incredible. It was just so many things going on, and the restaurants and the urban nature of everything. Our neighborhood was over the top, and the parks down the street, and I could ride my bike everywhere, and the subways, and the music scene, the cultural scene, the business scene. It was just absolutely fantastic. I had no idea. I was completely unprepared. Thank God for David Halberstam. Thank God for Red Auerbach. We used to practice at this place called Hellenic College, and it was right around the corner from Larry's house. So it was absolutely a spectacular scene. And just, we would come in there, and there would be the priests and the religious figures dressed in their big, long black robes and their big hats. And oh my gosh, it was super fun. And we had Wayne and Corky and Ray, our trainer, and just everybody. But the people in the front office, there was so many of them. There was Dwayne Johnson, who's still there to this day. There was Jeff Twiss, who's still there to this very day. Joe DiLorenzo. And it was a real family in every way. The sense that we were all in this together. And then the fans. The fans who came to the Garden in record numbers, but came ready to play. A lot of the NBA crowds are corporate crowds, and there's a lot of corporate stuff going on in Boston. But the Celtic fans, they wore their tennis shoes in the hope, in the dream, in the necessity that KC might put them into the game. Because our squad, our franchise, it was all about winning the game. And that's what Red was just so instrumental in. And he had created this culture. And he had worked with Bill Russell and Sam Jones and KC and Havlicek and Nelson and Satch Sanders and Cousy and just an endless list. All my heroes, all the guys that I idolized growing up. And then I got to be on the Celtics. And it was so much better than I ever could have possibly dreamed. I'm the luckiest guy in the world.
One of the guys you talked about earlier was Robert Parrish.
Right.
And coming into that situation, you know, I've heard that it was, you guys kind of had a mutual respect for each other, and he was very gracious in understanding what your role was going to be on the team and how you guys were going to fit together. Can you talk about that conversation and what that was like?
I'm a huge fan of Robert Parrish, and we had played against each other when he was in Golden State and I was in Portland. And then I was out of the league for so many years due to the injuries, and I was concerned in that I did not want Robert to feel that I was trying to take anything from him. And Robert, an incredible basketball player, an even better human being. And when I first got to Boston, the very first thing I did, right off the plane, I asked ML Carr to pick me up at the airport and take me over to Chief's house, just to make sure that Chief knew that I was only coming to help. I didn't want anything other than to be a part of a special team. That's what my whole life was about. And I had just spent 6 brutally long, painful, lonely, disastrous years on the Clippers. And I just desperately wanted to have it be fun again. I wanted to be part of something that was good and positive and upbeat and happy and the celebration of life that basketball always has been for me. And I didn't want Robert to think that there was any competition between us. I was there to support him. I was there to help him. I was there to play off the bench. And he couldn't have been nicer. He couldn't have been kinder.
Bill, I want to talk about the attitude of that team, the 85-86 Celtics. It's a different time in basketball as well. I mean, you guys were gritty and tough, but you had fun, and it was a cohesive unit. You know, Danny kind of poking at people. You had Larry joking around. I've read the stories in Peter May's book about you having the stripper on the court and all this other stuff. There was this sense of fun that you guys were able to maintain while being tough and gritty and professional. What was that like for you to come into a situation, kind of immediately fit in, and everybody was kind of this cohesive, kind of for lack of a better word, like badass unit of guys that were able just to have fun with it.
The Celtics were a championship team long before I ever got there. And it was the personalities that just made it so tremendous. You had Larry Bird, who was just this gigantic comet flashing across the universe and so hot. And being with Larry Bird is like being on a tropical island with just warm breezes wafting over you all the time. And then Danny Ainge is just, he is like somebody who's plugged him in and he's just always on and always going. And Dennis Johnson, one of the most explosive and combustible personalities I've ever been a part of, but also someone who wanted his peace and wanted his quiet on his terms. And then Robert Parrish, who during the games, always so stoic, had the stone face there, but in the locker room, on the bus rides, at the airports, at the hotels, just the life of the party. And it would be great to be on the bus after the game, and Chief would always sit in the very back seat in the middle, have his legs stretched up down the aisle, and he would have the stat sheet from the game, and he would just read it out loud to everybody, and he would review the game and critique the game. And then there was all the guys on the bench, or the cannon fodder. And it was a very special second unit. We were very close. But we knew that our role was to help. Our job was to do what the other guys couldn't do all day long. The first string, the stat team, they could do everything. But the games are so long, and there's so many of the games, that we knew our job was limited, but we had to come each and every day. We tried our best, but this was truly a starting five. Oh my gosh, for the ages. And then you had Kevin McHale, who beat everybody he ever played against. And Kevin's footwork, his moves, his imagination, his creativity, but more so his personality. He just loved the social aspects of being on the team, in the game, on the court, being the star. And it was just absolutely incredible what he was able to do day in and day out against Kareem, against Artis, against Moses, against Ralph, against Akeem, Ewing, you name it, he did it. And he just looked at him and he said, you guys have no chance, and they didn't. There has never been a player like Kevin McHale, who was unquestionably the second greatest low post player that I ever played against after Kareem.
The beginning of the season, you famously, you guys kind of came out the gate, the expectations were so high, and you came out the gate and you lost that first game, and you have the famous quote saying that you're a disgrace to basketball. How could you kind of go to that place so quickly? Were you just that upset and disappointed? Did you feel like you let everyone down, or what? It was just such a unique thing that it's game one and you had already kind of taken on this role that you needed to accomplish so much.
I played basketball to win. And when you do win, everybody on the team plays well. And when you lose, everybody stinks it up and it's time to get back to work. And we had this brilliant team and we should have won all the games. But we didn't, and I was responsible for a lot of the losses, including the very first one, when I just could not find anything of my game. I could not run, I could not shoot, I could not rebound. It was a disastrous performance. And at the end of the game, I took full responsibility, and I am a disgrace to the sport of basketball, and I let my team down, and we should have won that game.
Moving forward, though, very quickly, you know, when talking about Ryan, he called you the greatest passing big man of all time. How did you quickly find your way into that rotation, becoming the sixth man, and how did that come together where your passing game, you kind of started to, not that you didn't have it, but it just seemed to become a bigger part of your game and working with Larry and this kind of ESP out there on the court. How did that start to formulate early on in the season?
Starting the fast break was always my favorite part of the game. And that comes from idolizing Bill Russell and what he did to ignite the offense. The running game, that's what I like about basketball. fast break, up and down, let's get going. But when you are in the set offense, what could be better than helping your teammates play to a higher level? I was super lucky in that I started playing basketball when I was 8 years old, and I was just a little tiny guy. And so I learned about ball handling and dribbling and creativity and the penetration and the up and down nature of having the ball in your hand all the time, which leads to the decision making and the leadership responsibility and the organization of how the team is going to play. And so to be able to play with such incredible guys like Larry, Kevin, Chief, DJ, Danny, Scotty, Jerry, Flip, Greg, David, Sam, who could all run, think, catch, and then execute. You can throw the greatest pass in the world, but the guy's got bored hands, doesn't do anything. So, I mean, you throw a pass to any one of those guys, they're going to catch it and turn it into gold.
At what point did you feel like, I'm healthy, this is working, and this is, we really do have a shot to kind of run the table here in the East?
In my entire 14 years of professional basketball, I only finished the season twice. I was very fortunate to be on the Celtics when I was able to do it one of those times. The sense of invincibility that a great team has, to where you know that you can do whatever you want out there. And this Celtic team was so good because it could beat you in any way it wanted to. We could win an up and down game. We could win a slug it out, grind it out game. We could win a shooting game. We could win a rebounding game. We could win a defensive struggle. We could win a passing game. And the sense of versatility, the sense of interchangeability, the sense of we have individuals, but more importantly, we have a team. Because while four of the players on the team are on the NBA's all-time team, you have this squad who love to play, love to win, had this fantastic dream and vision of what could be the Boston Celtics. You had a teacher, a leader at the very top, Red Auerbach, and his surrogate, Casey Jones. And then you had the culture, you had the foundation, and then you had guys who were willing to sacrifice and discipline themselves. And so while everything was there in place, fans, business, arena, city, community, history, tradition, legacy, at the end of the day, we had Larry Bird, and nobody else did. And there's never been a player like Larry. There's been other good players, there's been other great players, but nobody who had the combination of everything that Larry had. Others have been bigger, others have been stronger, others have been faster, others have had greater numbers. I have never seen a player ignite the home crowd the way that Larry Bird did. Larry was so good, and his skill level, his passion, his mind, his spirit, his soul, just the smartest guy in the world. He loves to portray himself as the hick from French Lick and how none of this really matters, but Larry spent his whole life just dreaming about, okay, how am I going to get this done? And Larry never got tired of throwing 50 in your face.
I was going to say, he's a tough guy to impress. I mean, and he has spoken so highly of you, and he was so excited of you being there. How did that make you personally feel to kind of develop that relationship with him that you guys had both on and off the court? Because from what I've heard from, you know, talking to Jackie and Bob and people that were there, you guys really did. He didn't let a lot of people in, but he seemed like he really took to you.
Larry was the greatest player I ever played with. And his sense of kindness, his sense of patience. When you're as good as someone like Larry Bird is, you don't really have patience for other people or other things. But here I was dragging this wretched body around as much as I could. But his kindness, his willingness to be receptive to something, someone who was so totally different and so completely removed from so much of what his life has been about. The way that Larry treated our children, but really all children, he was the perfect person. So supportive, so encouraging, so constructive, and always so willing to just mix it up a little bit and let's take it to the next level. And to be able to play basketball with someone who thought and dreamed about it as much as he did. Because in life, it always comes down to anticipation. It always comes down to who can figure out what's next first. And that was Larry. And he was always ahead of everything in life, in business, in culture. And he was just one of those visionary dreamers that have changed the world. And as we see the innovation economy that we have today, particularly in Boston, particularly here in California, here was Larry in the 1980s, just omnipresent, completely dominant. Larry was so kind to our children. Our four boys would come to practice every day. They loved it. It was just so exciting for them after having seen the frustrations and the disappointments of my career come crumbling down with all the injuries and all the different problems. And then to have the opportunity to be a part of something fun and what sports is really all about. And Larry drove that. And when he would see the children, he would just always be so nice. And he would take them places and do things with them and just, he couldn't have been better. And then one year, he took the oldest two, Adam and Nate, with him to the NBA All-Star game. And he just said, you guys, you're coming with me. And he bought them their plane tickets, bought them their hotel room, and took them everywhere, and took them in the All-Star locker room, and introduced them all around. And there's nobody like Larry Bird.
The first round of the playoffs against the Bulls, one of the, this magical kind of moment where it was almost like this passing of the torch from Larry to Michael, and Michael with the 63-point game in that first round against the Bulls. What was that series like for you guys, and what was that like to kind of finally be in the playoffs and making this run towards another championship?
When you're really good, and that Celtic team was really good, the opposition, they're irrelevant. And we just played to the best standard that we could. And you're not responsible for the opposition, but it was fantastic, the teams we were able to play against on a regular basis. Philadelphia was an excellent team with Moses and Barkley and Dr. J. Dr. J, the single most dynamic, vibrant, and exhilarating player I ever played against. But there was this series against this up-and-coming team, the Chicago Bulls. And this was an era that predated the hype that has dominated sports of late. And so we had no idea. And people had heard of Michael Jordan and knew of his exploits at North Carolina, and we all knew and loved Dean Smith and everything that he did. But Michael comes on the scene and he lights us up. He goes for 49 points in the first game of his best of three series. We kind of looked around and said, he'll never do that again. The next game, he goes for 63 and fouls all of us out. We were saved in a double overtime game that was a 4-point victory for the Celtics by Larry Bird, who didn't foul out. He realized he had to stay in and keep filling it up. At the end of that game, we said, hey, this guy Michael, he's pretty darn good. Maybe we'll just double team him every time he gets the ball, no matter where he is on the court. 94 feet away in the backcourt, in the deep corner, wherever he gets it, let's just double team him and see what the rest of his guys can do. And that was the series. Because ultimately, in life, it's not how good you are, it's how good your team is. And as great as Larry is, as great as Larry was, he had phenomenal teammates around him. I mean, every one of those guys, DJ, Hall of Famer, Chief, NBA All-Time Team, Hall of Famer, Kevin, All-Time Player, Hall of Famer, All-Time Team, Danny, should be in the Hall of Fame. Danny is as great a player. My goodness, what an athlete. What a spirit, what a force. And then to have Larry. Larry, who could and did do anything he ever wanted. And he did it with his brain. And that was what made it so fun.
The fact that you guys kind of sweep through Milwaukee, you sweep through Atlanta kind of pretty effortlessly. And then the world's kind of waiting for this matchup between the Lakers and Boston. That doesn't happen. Was there a sense of disappointment that you, I mean, obviously it's great that you go into the finals, but was there a sense of disappointment that it wasn't going to be against the Lakers, especially for you?
There's never a sense of disappointment when you're going for the championship, unless you lose. It doesn't matter who you play. Who you play is based on what happens on the court. We played the best team that year. The Houston Rockets that year, that time, were better than the Lakers. And what Ralph Sampson and Hakeem Olajuwon and Robert Reed and all the different players that they had, they were coming. They were a team of the future that was sadly derailed by injuries down the line. But we knew that this Rocket team was very, very good, and we'd have to be at the top of our game if we were going to win the championship. But we knew we were going to win.
That series, I mean, what was it like once you were in there, kind of going back and forth, and especially the Game 5 game you guys lost? I've heard and read that you guys were pretty upset that it wasn't going the way you thought you were going to close it out at that point.
The games that the 1986 Celtic team lost were all teams that we could have and should have beaten, but we did not play with the mental fierceness, toughness, and tenacity that you need to win every single game. But the series was never really in doubt, and any of the opponents that we faced, Chicago, Atlanta, Milwaukee, Houston, they had good teams, but we had a great team. We had Casey Jones, and we had Red Auerbach. We had Kevin McHale, Dennis Johnson, Robert Parrish, Danny Ainge, Scott Wedman, Jerry Seasting. But what we really had was Larry Bird, because any time there was any doubt, hesitation, or indecision, Larry would just take over. And he would put on this remarkable display of not only basketball skills, but the human spirit. The way that he would just fly all over the court. Because here was a guy who wasn't the fastest, wasn't the highest jumper, wasn't the tallest, wasn't the strongest. But he was the best. And that's what makes basketball the perfect game. And that's why I fell in love with the way the Celtics played. Because that was Bill Russell. Bill Russell, who completely changed the course of history. And he never had the ball. He just guided the ball. He directed the ball. He pushed the ball. He passed the ball. He handed the ball off. He made everybody else better. Larry was a different type of player than Bill Russell. The spirit and the soul were the same. The dream, the vision, the passion, the goal was the same. But Larry, his game was putting it in your face. His game was knocking down jumpers. His game was keeping track of people that you had lost contact with during the course of the game. And he would find them. And he would throw passes. He would maneuver his teammates. He would maneuver the opposition. Larry Bird was like one of the great chess champions in the history of the world, in that it was always cerebral. It was always about position and skill and putting the opponent in a position that they had no chance, ever.
for you to win a championship at that time, I know it's about the team, but personally for you, was there a sense of redemption for what you had gone through with the physical injuries and at that point to be part of something like that, and how special was it? Both, like I said, personally and emotionally, but to be part of that kind of Celtics legacy and have your imprint part of that.
I was just so happy, and I'm still happy to this very day, because the joy, the fun, the laughter, the happiness that I try to live every day in my life, that was basketball. Basketball was the way that I expressed myself. I'm a lifelong stutterer. I'm very shy, I'm very reserved, and the inability to speak helped make me a better basketball player, because that was my stage. That was my platform to perform. And so here I was, a chance to be a part of something special, a chance to do something once in my life, but that chance just kept getting undercut because of the foot problems, because of the faulty foundation that prevented me from achieving my dreams and goals. And so now I get on this magnificent team, in this fantastic culture, in this incredible place with this phenomenal legacy and tradition and history. And it's just perfect. And I was just so happy. And we did win. There's never a guarantee. Things can always go wrong. But that day, that year, that team, my dreams did come true.
The aftermath of being part of a team like that and seeing the city respond, what was that like for you to be there in Boston and see that type of culture come to life?
Boston, the Celtics, Red, Chief, DJ, Danny, Larry, Kevin, Scotty, Jerry. It was everything I hoped for and better. And it all came true. You have these visions, you have these hopes in life that, wow, maybe it could happen. Maybe it could be me. Maybe it really could be that good. And it was. It all happened. And from the people to the place to the game to the court to the garden, it was just one of those things that you think about all the time. And when your reality becomes your hopes and aspirations, and then you understand how hard it is, but also how truly special it is, it changes your life forever. And I can never thank the people of Boston enough. I can never thank Red and Larry and all the guys who just, they gave me a chance. They allowed me to have my dreams come true.
Related to that time period, and one of the things that we're kind of discussing and talking about is how much the NBA has changed from that time period. And I've heard stories from talking to Bob and Jackie and Dan Shaughnessy about how different it was on the road at that time with the fans and with you. And they always said that you were kind of always willing to kind of sit down and talk about the game, have a beer and just sit down and be around other people and the media guys. And it's a little bit different now. What was it about you or your relationship with the those kind of who are now that legendary media people like Jackie, Bob, and Dan? What was that like to build that relationship with the media, and how different was it back then than today?
I just love being part of the team. I love being with the guys. And it was a fantastic period of the NBA in that, and David Stern had just come aboard, and he had completely changed the course of basketball history, the course of sport business history. But to just be with all the players, all the reporters, the broadcasters, and in the hotels, at the airports, and at the gym, and in the restaurants and in the bars and just having the time of our life because we were all in it together. And the sense of learning from these fantastically interesting people who had so many experiences, so many different things going on in their lives, and just to be able to learn, to be able to share, to be able to understand. And you know, in life, you learn what's important: friendships, experiences, health, which leads to the skills that you need in life, and that is balance, keeping it all in perspective, and then quickness, the mental competition, the mental acuity to become the champion. And with that Celtic team, everybody, the fans who had seen the best of the best, that Bill Russell era, the Cowens, Havlicek, Nelson, Silas, JoJo White era, and then the Bird era. And so they knew what was happening. And then to be able to sit and have lunch and talk basketball with Red Auerbach, and just the mental relationships that you had with everybody. And then the social aspects of just, hey, we're having the time of our lives. We're playing great basketball.
The last thing I was going to ask you about is one of your favorite topics. And I've heard the story that you took a lot of the guys to a Grateful Dead concert. Mm-hmm. And what was that like, kind of bringing your own personal element to the team? Something that you're very famously known for, your love and appreciation for the Grateful Dead and for music in general. What was that like to have people kind of look at you in that light and share that with your team?
I was always very self-conscious about not wanting to be disruptive to this already championship team. But one day I was warming up at practice and Larry and Kevin came over and cornered me. And they said, "What's going on, Walton?" I said, "What are you talking about?" "Oh, come on, you know, come on. There's all these new people in town. They all have long hair. They're all wearing those funny tie-dye shirts that you always wear, and they smell really weird. What's going on?" I said, "I have no idea what you guys are talking about." And so Larry and Kevin said, "Come on, are the Grateful Dead in town?" I admitted that they were on their way. "Is there going to be a concert?" "Yes." "Are you going?" "Yes." "Do you think we could come too, Bill?" "I think we could work something out." And so we all met at Larry's house, and Larry was kind enough to arrange a fleet of limousines for us. And the whole team came, everybody except Danny. His wife Michelle wouldn't let him come. And so we went to the concert, and it was just absolutely spectacular. And it was so fun, and to have such a big part of my life, my friends in the Grateful Dead, meet the basketball team that I was on, and to have it be in such a spectacular hotbed of the world of the Grateful Dead, and how perfect it was to see all the things that a great band and a great team represent and mean to everybody, and to have it just come together in this most remarkable harmonic convergence. And when the concert was over, they all looked at me with their kaleidoscope eyes, and they said, "Wow, can we come back tomorrow?" And that they did.
I always wanted to ask you, just your ability as a musician and being part of that music, how much does that relate to basketball, or how much is there, for lack of a better word, the harmonious aspects of that? You have five guys in a band, you have five guys on a team. Does that kind of correlate for you, or has that always correlated for you?
Being on a team, being in a band, it's all the same. You have the great thought processes that go into it. You have the skill development requirements. You have the imagination. You have the use of the technological tools that will allow you to chase your dreams. You have the fans that drive you and push you. You have the leadership. You have the human values and personal characteristics of being in a group dynamic, including empathy, to understand how hard it is and how tough it is, but also how fragile it is, because you never really know how it's going to play out. And that's why when I look at the Grateful Dead, when I look at the Boston Celtics, Larry Bird and Jerry Garcia are really the same person.
They met too, didn't they?
Oh yeah, no.
They met, right? What's that like for you, look over in the corner and they're sitting there talking?
It was so rewarding to be able to introduce the two different groups, because really the goal was the same. The goal was to reach a level of peak performance on command that would just create joy, that would create happiness, that would create a positive future, a shining star on the horizon, a beacon of hope that people could look at and say, wow, that's just so cool. Let's keep coming back here. Let's do this some more. And the sense of pride, the sense of loyalty, the sense of gratitude that goes into fantastic performances over time. That's the Boston Celtics. That's the Grateful Dead. I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be part of both of them.
30 years later, you know, especially with Golden State kind of trying to accomplish some things that are in your realm, what's it like for you to sit back and be like, wow, this is still talked about as the greatest team of all time?
30 years. Who would have ever thought? It seems like yesterday. The way the Celtics played, great defense, great teamwork, great passion, great purpose, discipline, focus, all the things that go into a historically dominant and important team. This was a squad that has had impact. And when you look at people's lives, when you look at the history of basketball and sport, and when you look at the current state of the game, and you see what teams like San Antonio, you see what LeBron James does, and then you look at the Golden State Warriors, the current champions, and you see the ball movement, and you see the selflessness, you see the leadership, you see the brilliant player. Well, one of the most fun things about being part of a great team is that when you get hot and it's your day and you're going and you're in the rhythm, there, everybody else is just so happy for you, because that's the nature of a family. And that sense of being part of a true team, that you're happy for other people's success. When you have that, and we see that with the Spurs, we see that with the Golden State Warriors, and really all championship teams, it doesn't always last very long, but the Celtics, they epitomize everything that's great in the world, on and off the court. I'm a proud, loyal, and grateful Celtic.
Looking at the modern day, what was it like for you when the Celtics, because it was such a long span, it was 22 years before they won another championship. What was it like for you to kind of see that moment happen, and it kind of brought back all of what you had accomplished with 86, and it still kind of lives on?
I was so happy when the Celtics were able to win the championship with KG and Ray Allen and Paul Pierce and Danny Ainge being the architect of that team, and to see how it all came together, and then how immediately the Celtic fans were just right back on top of it, pushing and standing up and wearing the green and wearing their tennis shoes to the games. And wow, to be a Boston Celtic, dreams do come true.
Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Bill Walton. We hope you enjoyed another episode of CSNNE.com's podcast series on the 86 Celtics. Again, make sure to look for new episodes every Tuesday and Thursday on CSNNE.com or subscribe to our iTunes feed. I am Abby Chin, and we will see you on the next episode of the 86 Celtics interviews.